Okay, good to be here with all of you. The topic tonight is a sort of complicated. And I will just, I guess, you'll just be hearing about the things that have been interested me in my own practice lately, what things I've been working with, and hopefully you'll hear something that might help you with your practice, your understanding of the Dharma. I was sort of preparing this talk and I found a quote from a book called Why We Meditate. And I thought, well, that should just be the name of every Dharma talk, right? Why we meditate. So anyway, the point of the talk is that it's really that our perceptions lead to our thoughts. In other words, how we perceive something, that's kind of how we name it, how we label it. And then based on that, we tend to proliferate additional thoughts around whatever object we've just identified. And the Buddha talked about how this proliferation of mind, there's a Pali word, Pali being an ancient Indian language, similar to Sanskrit. The Pali word is papancha for proliferation of thought. And I love that word because it sort of sounds like what it means. Pancha. I think we should just adapt it into English, but that's me. Anyway, but the idea is that it can really keep us distracted, lost in thought. It kind of takes us away from this present moment, right? And as we know from our mindfulness practice, our insight meditation practice, we're really trying to value, to center, awareness happening now, this present moment, trying to keep coming back to what's here. And then at some point we even let go of the present moment, right? That's another Dharma talk. But we're trying to stay, and this is not to say that it's not useful to think about the future and the past at times, but we're really talking about the type of thinking that I think is particularly easy to get caught up in these days. If you turn on the news for like 1 minute, you could be in trouble, at least if you're me. So this is just an important reminder. And even when I'm trying to prepare a talk like this, it's this proliferation of thought that will take me away. I'll be sitting there working on the talk, and then I'll think, I haven't bought a new pair of pants in a while. I wonder where people get pants these days. And the next thing I know, I'm researching, men's pants for 20 minutes. I was supposed to be working on my Dharma talk. So it's just amazing how I think the way we're sitting at these computers where we can just do so much so fast. But it's interesting because the mind has always had this ability, right? Even in ancient India, when they didn't have the internet, this was an issue, right? That the Buddha noted and brought up. So now we're just even in more trouble, you might say, because it's so easy. There's so many ways to get distracted. If it's not my phone sending me a notification, it's my, computer that I'm working on, or it's my dog barking, or the neighbor starting up some mechanism, loud leaf blower or whatever it is. So you just the practice is really and the reason I bring in equanimity is because none of this is going to go away unless we move to a cave. They just discovered a Russian woman living with two children, two small children in a cave in India. Anyway, we don't need to I don't really know that much about the story, but it sounded interesting. So unless we're going to live in a cave and turn off all the modern technologies, we're going to have all these things to deal with. So the flip side of being lost in thought, one way to put it is equanimity, right? This balance of mind that we can cultivate. And the Buddha, it is said, had tremendous equanimity after his awakening, his enlightenment, and also other awakened beings. There was a quote I came across that I liked. So one of my teachers in recent years has been Bhikkhu Anālayo, the German monk and scholar. He's a pretty amazing scholar, really, just cranks out these amazing books on early Buddhism. And one of his more recent books is called The Signless and the Deathless. So he just kind of keeps, going to really, to me, really fascinating, deep Dharma topics. And here's the quote that jumped out at me. He says, "The imperturbable nature of the mind of an arahant, a fully enlightened being, can be illustrated with the help of an image which the texts," he means the suttas, early discourses of Buddhism, "which the texts compared to a firm gatepost." That's just a simile. "And in the case of an arahant, such firmness of this gatepost applies to equanimity in relation to anything experienced. The relevant passage proclaims that the mind of a fully awakened one cannot be perturbed by whatever happens at any sense door, just as a mountain or a column firmly planted in the ground will not be shaken by wind from the four directions." And partly their mind is free from lust, anger, and delusion. But I don't know, this struck me because this is kind of what in for at least some of us are practicing towards, right? We would at least like to be moving in the direction of an arahant, and that if we achieve that, it might partly be characterized by this sense of an unperturbable mind, imperturbable mind. And anyway, so that kind of jumped out at me in relation to the topic tonight. And so, kind of like a lot of Buddhist teachings, we have to just remember that the teaching is coming from the viewpoint of someone with that type of mind, right? But we, unfortunately, probably aren't there yet. So it can sound a little, pretty far out there, right? But the beauty is that the Buddha did a great job of kind of explaining how he got there in different ways that we can start to, learn about and put into practice or attempt to put into practice. And so one of these is around understanding how perception leads to proliferation of thought and kind of takes us, gets us lost and kind of not so, the mind is kind of the opposite of this sense of equanimity, with the firmness of this post stuck in the ground. I will say that this is kind of my own idea that I'm putting together, and so we'll see if it holds up, and I look forward to the Q&A section. But anyway, and of course, everything starts with mindfulness. We're cultivating mindfulness, and then bringing in investigation, the second of the seven factors of awakening, and we're looking at our experience, and in this case, noticing how perception leads to this proliferation of thought. So Joseph Goldstein, in his book Mindfulness, writes that the third of the five aggregates is perception, and they say the five aggregates of clinging, and they are material form, so the body and all materiality, and then feeling tone, so whatever happens at the sense doors we experience as either pleasant, unpleasant, or kind of neutral, and that's feeling tone. And then next is perception. And then perceptions followed by volitional formations or, thinking. And then the fifth one is consciousness. And we kind of take these, we cling to these as a me in some way or other, as kind of who I am. And the Buddha pointed out that that's kind of a delusion. So Joseph goes on to say, perception, like feeling, is singled out from all the other mental factors as one of the aggregates because of its prominent role in the process, both of our conditioning and our liberation. So Joseph goes on, perception is the factor that picks out the distinguishing marks of an object, names it, names the object, and then remembers the word or concept and applies it the next time we experience that particular object. So when we hear a sound, perception recognizes it, names it bird, for example, and applies the same name the next time the sound is heard again. And when perception and mindfulness are balanced, they work together in the service of insight. And then Joseph goes on to say elsewhere in his book, Mindfulness, that perception is the mental factor that interprets experience by recognizing and remembering the distinguishing features of an object, as we just said. And in the simplest examples, perception recognizes the difference between red and blue, hot and cold, man and woman, or et cetera. And then, but there is one understanding, he says, one understanding here that's critical to our freedom. Perceptions are not absolutes, they are conditioned on many different levels. So one of the great misconceptions we often carry throughout our lives is that our perceptions of ourselves and the world are basically accurate and true, that they reflect some stable ultimate reality. This misconception leads to tremendous suffering, both globally and in our personal situations. So, like in Zen, I remember hearing Jon Kabat-Zinn talk about his Zen teacher who would always say, don't know, that we needed to cultivate don't know mind. So that it's interesting that don't know mind is a valuable way to look at the world rather than I am perceiving everything and labeling it perfectly. And so it's funny because I was at a bakery today and this kind of happened where there's these certain turnovers that they bake and sell every Wednesday, only on Wednesday. And my daughter really loves, especially the cherry one, but they didn't have that today. But anyway, to me, the second best one is the blackberry peach turnover that they sometimes do. And so I was talking to the salesperson and, first of all, you have to wait in this long line. It's a very popular bakery. And then it's my turn to order. And she's saying, well, all we have, we don't have cherry today, because I asked about that. All we have is blackberry apricot. And I kept looking at the sign and I just would have sworn it said blackberry peach. And I don't, like, my mind saw the word peach. I don't know how to explain it. And I questioned her because I was believing my own perception more than her telling me point blank it's apricot. And so then I realized, and honestly, this was mindfulness, right? I was like, I better check this out before I argue any further. So I stepped a little closer, and sure enough, it said apricot, even though the same word had looked like peach from further away. And so then I quickly was like, oh, I see what you mean. Thank you. I'll take two of those or whatever. But it was just funny how my perception was wrong in that moment, even though my eyesight's usually pretty good, especially from a distance. So that was just interesting. So Joseph goes on, what are some of the relative conditions? Some examples of the relative conditioned nature of perception. On one level, the way we see things is based on our karmic predispositions. What a vulture might see as a delectable meal, we would see as very unappetizing, rotting flesh. Same object, different perceptions. They say when a pickpocket sees a saint, all he sees is the saint's pockets, that kind of thing. It's an old one. So, cultural conditioning also influences how we see things. The Buddhist scholar Rune Johansson wrote, "Things are seen through the lenses of our desires, prejudices, and resentments, and are transformed accordingly." And Joseph goes on, "We can see the bias of our perceptions in more ordinary circumstances of our lives. Some years ago, I was involved in a highly charged organizational conflict," Joseph says. "It seemed so obvious to me that I was seeing the situation clearly. Of course, those with opposing views thought the same thing. Communications were getting very heated, with feelings of anger and defensiveness running high. At a certain point, feeling my own suffering and that of others, I stepped back and asked myself a question that proved very freeing. Why do others feel the way they do? How are they perceiving the situation?" And he says, "As soon as I was no longer caught in attachment to my own perception of things, I became less caught in judging and blaming, and it became much easier to understand other people's strong feelings." So, this is just a great reminder. So, sort of similar to my story about the bakery, but a little more poignant, I guess. The last thing from Joseph here, it's another thing he mentions. Our perceptions are also conditioned by the latent tendencies in the mind, the habitual projections that color how we view ourselves in the world. For example, a common perception in meditation is that a pleasant sitting is good and a painful one is bad. Anybody had that experience? Although we may know intellectually that this isn't true, this felt assessment comes from perceptions conditioned by the latent tendencies of desire and aversion. And then he kind of concludes, "What makes the Buddha's understanding of the mind so powerful is the recognition that because perceptions are conditioned by our mental habits, we also train our perceptions in a way that supports happiness and freedom." And I guess one thing that jumped out at me is that this idea that we could train our perceptions, and I think the only way we can do that is with a lot of mindfulness to really be paying attention to how all this operates. And then we might have a chance to kind of retrain our perceptions. It was interesting. So I kind of grew up playing tennis, and my parents played tennis all the time. Tennis was a big part of my life, and so I still, can get caught up watching some Wimbledon finals, that kind of thing. And there was just a statement from Carlos Alcaraz, who was in the recent men's Wimbledon finals but lost to, Jannik Sinner. And wait, was it Sinner? Now I forget if it was Sinner talking about Alcaraz or Alcaraz talking about Sinner, but I think it was Alcaraz actually talking about after he beat Sinner at the French Open, which happened right before Wimbledon. He was saying that he started to say Sinner's failure to win at the French Open affected, how he prepared for the Wimbledon tournament. But the key was he started to say failure, but he reframed it as, just loss or something. But the idea was not to see it as a failure. It's simply, this is what happened. Darn, I'm sorry, I didn't prepare this. It just popped into my mind. I was thinking it was a great story. But the idea was he wasn't calling it a failure just because you don't win. It was just seeing it as, oh, well, you lost this match, no big deal. Having become a pickleball player in more recent years, that's definitely the attitude of most pickleball players. It's like, oh, I lost that one. Oh, well, move on to the next game. That's one of the beauties of pickleball. It's very easy to just not take it too badly if you lose. But anyway, I just appreciated the way, we can reframe things. We don't have to consider it some terrible failure if we lose, one of the most biggest tennis matches in the world because, hey, we got to the match, right? We were in the game. All right. So just to say that these are ways we can train perceptions would be reframing how we talk about it, how we think about it. And so the Buddha kind of broke the perceptual process down in a certain way. It was in a it's in a sutta called the Honeyball Sutta, and I have Bhikkhu Anālayo, who I mentioned earlier. He has a book where he talks about that. He's written a lot about it. And he says in his Satipatthana book, the conditioned character of the perceptual process is a central aspect of the Buddha's analysis of experience. And according to the Honeyball Sutta, the conditional sequence of the average perceptual process leads from contact via feeling tone that we mentioned before, which is pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So first there's contact at the sense door, then there's that feeling of, oh, this is pleasant, I want more of it, or unpleasant, I don't want it. Then cognition or perception, which comes after feeling or feeling tone, and then this goes to thought, which can in turn stimulate conceptual proliferation, the papancha that I mentioned. And that this is happening all the time, right? We're all working with this, moment after moment in our lives. Such conceptual proliferations tend to give rise to further concoctions of proliferations and cognitions. So it just keeps going, it sort of snowballs, which lead from the originally perceived sense data to all kinds of associations concerning past, present, and future. So this just kind of how it works. And I was thinking about it in terms of Cambridge, the city of Cambridge, because my wife grew up in Cambridge and I grew up in a small town in Virginia. And so we'd gone to Cambridge many times. And her experience of Cambridge is so much different than mine because I have no previous associations with it other than, now I've been there quite a few times, but she has her whole childhood was there, right? And she has so many memories. So we're all walking through Harvard Square. It's a very, what she remembers or notices is all the things that aren't there anymore. Whereas I didn't know about that, right? So I have so much fewer associations. So she's got all this, conceptual proliferation happening just by taking a short walk through Harvard Square, whereas I'm just like checking out all the sights and whatever. So just kind of interesting how that works. So the Bhikkhu Anālayo goes on. He says the Pali verb forms employed in this passage from the Honeyball Sutta indicate that the last stage of this perceptual process is an event of which one is the passive experiencer. I just find this interesting. Once the conditioned sequence of the perceptual process has reached the stage of conceptual proliferation, one becomes, as it were, a victim of one's own associations and thoughts, kind of like somebody who grew up in Cambridge walking through Harvard Square. So it happens automatically at a certain point once it kicks in. The thought process proliferates, weaving a net built from thoughts, projections, and associations of which the thinker has become almost a helpless prey, he says. In the crucial stage in the sequence where the subjective bias can set in and distort the perceptual process occurs with the initial appraisal of feeling tone and cognition or perception. So initial distortions of the sense data arising at this stage will receive further reinforcement by thinking and by conceptual proliferation. Once the stage of conceptual proliferation is reached, the course is set. So the place that we have to be really paying attention is right at the beginning, at the sense doors, and that when the feeling tone comes in of pleasant, unpleasant, and then also just the first moment of cognition, recognition, you might say, of say we smell something and we realize, oh, that's the bakery or whatever. But so we could just take that in and just be like, oh, that smells good. Or we could be like, oh, I remember when I was a little kid and my dad would take me to this same bakery. Oh, it's so sad that he died last year. And like we can just really take off. And then and what they're saying here is that if we're, once that process kicks in, we can't help ourselves, right? It's just we're off to the races. And what's interesting, Thanissaro Bhikkhu, a Buddhist monk and another translator of from Pali and scholar, he says of this word papancha, in terms of translating it, he had this little note about translating the word papancha. And he says, as one writer has noted, the word papancha has had a wide variety of meanings in Indian thought, with only one constant. In Buddhist philosophical discourse, it carries negative connotations, usually of falsification and distortion. The word itself is derived from a root that means diffuseness, spreading, proliferating. And the Pali commentaries define papancha as covering three types of thought: craving, conceit, and views. They also note that it functions to slow the mind down in its escape from samsara. So when we have tendencies towards a lot of this papancha, then we're kind of trapped in samsara, trapped in, a sense of suffering in some way or other. But I guess what jumped out at me is that there's only one constant, which is that in Buddhist terms, it carries negative connotations. So the Buddha really, because I used to want to be a, I used to think I was going to write the great American novel, and I really wanted to be, Ernest Hemingway or John Updike or somebody like that. And I kept a lot of notebooks, and I really valued proliferation of thought, right? I was writing everything down all the time. And I'm not saying that's all terrible. I kind of enjoy looking at some of that writing nowadays, but I also realized from a Buddhist standpoint, most of it was kind of suffer. It was suffering in different ways. Usually I was writing, about some job that wasn't going well or some relationship that wasn't going well or, but it was just a lot of proliferation of thought, most of which probably wasn't really all that useful. But anyway, so just to say that I kind of trained myself to be good at proliferating thought, and now I'm being told by my Buddhist teachers or whatever, this is not such a high value target after all. So that's why maybe this is an important teaching for me to really study closely. And really, this is all about, easing suffering and also cultivating happiness and well-being. And so I mentioned the book, Why We Meditate, earlier, and it's written by Daniel Goleman and Sokhne Rinpoche. Daniel Goleman, I think he originally was a writer for the New York Times and wrote about emotional intelligence and things like that. And then Sopnyi Rinpoche is a well-known Tibetan teacher. I actually have sat a Dzogchen style retreat with him, found him to be a wonderful teacher. So they wrote this book together. And Daniel Goleman is writing the part I'm going to share. He says there are two kinds of happiness. The first, as Rinpoche points out, meaning Sopnyi, depends on what happens to us in the course of a day. And while it gives us, quote, ups when good things happen, we can take a dive into bad feelings if life doesn't go well. And that emotional seesaw can gradually wear, he says, gradually wore away my retreat high. He was talking about some retreat he'd been on, but it can, wear away. We might wake up feeling in a good mood, but the ups and downs of the day may take a toll on the general good mood. So then the second kind of happiness, more steady, comes from within and stays with us no matter what occurs. That's what Sopnyi Rinpoche calls essence love, with its telltale feeling of okayness, where we can be happy for no particular reason. Now, I'm kind of equating this with equanimity. So we'll talk about equanimity more in a few minutes. So it's where we can be happy for no particular reason. That is, not depending on something outside ourselves to make us feel good. It's a steady, upbeat quality, no matter what may be happening. Even disappointments, frustrations, setbacks. We lost the finals at Wimbledon or whatever, but we don't have to, it doesn't have to, make us miserable. And he does refer to all this later as equanimity, no matter what happens. This steady, upbeat quality. So the closest parallel to okayness, this is where we bring in the science, because that's Daniel Goleman's job. The closest parallel to okayness in psychology may be the new field of well-being, which borrows a Greek word, eudaimonia, sometimes translated as flourishing, and the realization and scientific verification that this positive inner state can be cultivated. So well-being is a skill. That's kind of the point here. And largely thanks to the brain's neuroplasticity, he says. And the more we practice a given routine, even well-being, the stronger the underlying brain circuitry becomes. And that goes for meditation practice just as it does for a golf swing, he says. Or I would say a pickleball serve, but that's me. So then he goes on, research at Harvard and elsewhere finds that the more the mind wanders, the worse we feel. So this jumped out at me based on our topic today, that actually research has shown what the Buddha said 2,600 years ago, that the more our mind wanders, the worse we feel. In other words, it has these negative connotations. And Goleman writes, so for instance, the more time people spend doom scrolling on their mobile phones, the more likely they are to report being depressed. And on the other hand, Richie Davison, who does research out of University of Wisconsin on advanced meditators, their research group has found that being able to bring our attention to what's going on in and around us in the present moment predicts a stronger sense of well-being. So, in other words, some research has shown that just as the sort of proliferation of thought leads to a sense of depression, really practicing being more present has been shown to lead to these more positive mind states, according to the research. So I thought that was really interesting. And there are, yeah, that's the key thing there. So it's just always nice when science backs up what we're what the Buddha was saying many years ago. And this sort of seemed to kind of be what I, the gist of what my message is tonight. It's just around this, that we want to, because for me anyway, it's helpful to just sort of see what should I be emphasizing in my practice day to day, right? And so when I'm lost doom scrolling, because we won't get into politics, but when the latest whatever has happened in the news and I am doom scrolling about it, that doesn't tend to lead to a very good feeling, right? I can't remember the last time I doom scrolled and felt good about it. But meanwhile, when I remember to just like, I'm a big fan of airplane mode on my phone. So I just put the phone in airplane mode for a little while and just take a break, maybe go out in the backyard. I mean, whatever we can do to give ourselves that mental pause and to come back to just this present moment. And to, as there's a sutta, the Bahia Sutta, where this guy who thought maybe he was enlightened, Bahia in ancient India, and then he has basically a deva who, you don't have to believe in the devas necessarily. It's sort of like a spirit tells him, you're not enlightened, Bahia, you're mistaken. And then Bahia is very kind of perturbed by this. He's like, wait, I'm not. Well, who is? Is there somebody that could show me how to get enlightened? And the deva says, yes, there is one person, the Buddha. He's really far away on the other side of India, the continent of India or whatever. And Bahia drops everything and walks across the Indian continent to get to the Buddha, who knows, as these stories go. And then when he gets to the Buddha's on alms round and doesn't really want to be bothered, but Bahia asks three times, please tell me what I need to do to realize your teachings, kind of. And the Buddha, as he usually did, takes compassion on Bahia and says, well, in the seen, there is only the seen. In the heard, there is only the heard. In the cognized, there's only the cognized. He says, this is how you should train, Bahia. And what is seen, let there be just the seen. And what is heard, let there be just the heard. And what is sensed, let there be just the sensed. And what is cognized, let there be just the cognized. Then, Bahia, you will not be in that. And when you are not in that, there is no you there. When there is no you there, then you are neither here nor there nor in between. This, just this, is the end of suffering. So it's kind of a cryptic saying, but Bahia got it right away, apparently. So he was an experienced practitioner of some spiritual tradition or other and did have some, wasn't that as wasn't that far, and so the Buddha was able to just point him in the right direction, and it worked. And but the way I one of the ways I see this is that stop all your mental proliferation, right? Just when you're looking at something, just see it as it is without adding anything extra, and don't get caught up in proliferating any other thought around it. And so anyway, that's this is kind of the way we would practice towards reducing the proliferation. And this is why retreats are very helpful, where we can practice just being mindful moment to moment throughout the day. And in the scene, there's just the scene, and the taste it. I mean, for me, somehow food is a key one. Can I just eat the food without sort of getting caught in, oh, I really like this, but I really don't like this very much. And that's where you can really see the feeling tone coming in. And one of the stories I tell about that is where I grew up not liking Brussels sprouts, right? And I don't know if it was because my mom was serving, canned Brussels sprouts or something. I don't even, is that a thing? I don't know. But for some reason, I did not have a good feeling about Brussels sprouts. So my idea about them was that they were bad and I did not like them. And then I was on this retreat at Spirit Rock out here in California, and I swear they just kept serving Brussels sprouts like every other day. And it would be kind of a big part of the meal. And at first I was just automatically skipping it. But then as the retreat wore on and my mindfulness grew, I started to see it less as this label Brussels sprouts and just, oh, there's a sort of round, interesting looking green vegetable, And anyway, and I started putting it on my plate, and then at some point, just started eating it, and I realized it was not unpleasant. It was actually pretty neutral with a very slight pleasant. I mean, now I actually like Brussels sprouts, but at this was a process. But this is kind of what we're talking about too, that we come into things with these biases. And so part of the practice is to question the bias, and we have to have a certain level of mindfulness and, you might say, equanimity, balance of mind, to help us, be willing to investigate these things. And also that don't know mind that I mentioned before is helpful as well. Even to see it as just a green vegetable, don't know. So that was one of my little, I guess, insights into all this. And let's see. So let me think. Well, we haven't talked that much about equanimity. Maybe we'll talk about that some more. So let's see. The equanimity is one of the Brahma Viharas, or divine abodes. There's, loving kindness, compassion, altruistic joy, and which is my favorite translation now of that, and then also equanimity. And equanimity is often called evenness of mind or balanced mind. Christina Feldman, in her book The Boundless Heart, says the Pali Sanskrit word that we usually translate as equanimity, it's upekkha, and we can find a number of different translations that endeavor to capture its meaning. One is to look over, or to be a guardian of, to see with patience and as standing in the middle of life with a boundless poise and balance. So it has to do with poise, balance. And then she says some refer to equanimity as a spacious stillness of the heart. And that's one of my favorite ways of thinking of it. This is when we're really feeling a strong sense of equanimity. We may feel it to this level where it feels like a spacious stillness of the heart. Then she says equanimity is not a future state or attainment, but a way of engaging with all that this present moment is revealing. I think that's a nice phrase too, that it's a way of engaging with all that this present moment is revealing. So we're kind of, it gives us that stillness and balance of mind where we're ready for whatever's here. We're ready to meet what's here, even if it's unpleasant. Certainly this comes in handy if you're parenting or grandparenting or teacher, babysitter, whatever. Kids can really get have big reactions to things, and our role may be to the kid might be dysregulated, and our role is to help them just by remaining calm in the face of their extreme reactivity. Yes, I am thinking of something that happened very recently because I have a daughter who's still pretty young, and but we also have the inner child that could get can have these big reactions to things, so it's both, right? It's not just on the outside, and but the practice really helps us cultivate this spacious stillness of the heart. And she uses in that book, Christina Feldman talks about ill will, and this is actually was a passage that helped me come up with this topic for today's talk. So I'll share this passage with you. She writes, "In ill will, we bind ourselves to the person we fear. We avoid and distance ourselves. We find ourselves creating an other, investing the other with the implicit power to shatter our hearts. In the face of injury or hurt, we sense the tendency to seize upon a fragment of another person and mistake it to be the whole. We become preoccupied with an insult, hurt by an act of ill will or indifference, and we decide that the person before us is cruel, hateful, or ignorant. A decade could pass before we see the person again, yet the moment our eyes catch sight of the person, we see only the person we've determined them to be, unacceptable and intimidating, as an example. This selective perception," she says, "closes the door not only to kindness and compassion, but also to equanimity. The other, quote unquote, becomes frozen in time and space by our fear, and instead of being willing to be equally near all things, we are driven by the desire to distance ourselves," in the case of ill will. Of course, it could be the opposite, where it could be, some kind of desire situation where the desire isn't to distance ourselves, the desire is to be closer to the person or object or job or whatever it is. So it could work different ways, but that's just a good little summary. And the selective perception closes the door, as she says, not only on kindness, but also to equanimity. Just thought that was an interesting line. So the other thing Sharon Salzberg says that I found interesting, she says that equanimity appears as the secret ingredient of mindfulness. It has a sense of wisdom in it. Classically, mindfulness means a quality of awareness where our perception of what's happening in the moment is not distorted by personal bias. So, in other words, this is exactly what we're kind of talking about today. The Sharon goes on to say there is equanimity towards what we are perceiving without reactivity. If anger arises, we don't want to do a bunch of add-ons like acting out or hating. Within itself, anger is constantly changing, and it's a complex compound of sadness, fear, etc. So what matters is being able to see into the heart of experience with equanimity and to develop wisdom. It's the equanimity embedded in the mindfulness that allows us to see more clearly. She also says mindfulness doesn't mean we never respond to anything or never feel anything. If the smoke alarm goes off while you're meditating, get up and get out of there. So I think I just found that to be a helpful from teaching. And then Joseph Goldstein, I think this was Sharon quoting him, but he would often say, "Why are you adding a miserable story on top of a painful experience?" So often we'll have a painful experience and then we add a miserable story on top of it. This is the proliferation that's just really not helpful, right? And certainly I used to be guilty of it. I talked about how I grew up playing a lot of tennis, and I remember I would think, well, if I win this match, then I'm a really good person. Like I would somehow really equate it with some kind of personal success. And then if I lost, it was just so terrible. Like I would take it on as some kind of, I'm a loser because I couldn't beat this person in tennis or whatever. And but I really beat myself up over it, and like added a miserable story on top of, but really everything's coming out of causes and conditions. And so in Buddhism, what we're trying to do is see, oh, well, what were the causes and conditions that led to me, maybe losing this one? And this is what I was talking about with the Wimbledon guys. So the same two players played in the French Open finals and then the Wimbledon finals with two different results, right? And so presumably the guy that lost the first time and then won the next one didn't just say, "Oh, I'm a loser because I lost the first one and I'm never going to amount to anything," or he just said, "What can I learn from that loss, and how can I, better prepare the next time?" So but unfortunately that is not quite how I operated, a long time ago growing up. But what's really nice is I started playing pickleball, which sounds kind of silly or something, but for me it's been very healing to play pickleball in recent years because I don't do this to myself anymore. So and it's just been really interesting to be able to put these teachings to use, even, in a pickleball game where even, I guess it was yesterday, I went to some new courts I'd never been to. They just redid these courts or whatever. And there was this big sign that said advanced. So only advanced players were supposed to play on this one court. I do not consider myself an advanced player, but there were no other people playing. And so then basically they said, "Do you want to play?" And I think there was a time where I would have just said, "No, I'm not advanced. I'm not playing," right? But I was able to just sort of have don't know mind. I'm like, I don't know if I can play with these guys or not. So I just kind of went in there and gave it my best. And there was even a point where the guy I was playing with, it's all doubles. We were losing 9-2. You're playing to 11. We were losing 9-2. Again, the old me would have been like, "Oh, I'm terrible. I'm not at it, even close to advance. We're losing because of me, whatever." But I just kind of stayed present. I didn't really do anything special, but I just didn't add a miserable story on top of, a point deficit, right? And strangely enough, we started to come back. We actually ended up winning the game, like 11-9 or something. So, and that, I mean, the guy I was playing with was really good, so that was helpful. But and I'm not saying it was all me, but it was more just that I just was able to notice that my own attitude didn't bring me down in that situation. So I wish that I could have played tennis knowing what I know now, Anyway, I feel like I'm just doing a lot of talking. So I appreciate your attention here, and I hope this has been a useful discussion or talk for everyone. And I think I basically said what I had to say here. I'll just end. Joseph Goldstein had a offered a recent definition that he heard from somewhere else, but he didn't say where. The definition of dukkha is the word usually translated as suffering. And this was that dukkha is the inevitability of unwanted experiences. The inevitability of unwanted experiences, right? And I just love that because this, so we need equanimity, right? Equanimity is the way that we work with unwanted experiences without getting lost in reactivity. And in terms of the perception, it's just helpful to see how the perception happens and to realize that the antidote is cultivating mindfulness so that we are present with at the sense doors when the feeling tone and then the perception, the labeling come in, that we don't then get caught in that proliferation of thought that at a certain point we lose control over it and we can't stop it. But if we're really present at that initial moment, then we have a lot more freedom of choice. And that this is kind of what the Buddha was pointing to. And this is where the freedom really lies. We can proliferate thought about just about anything, right? It's kind of fascinating just to see. Gil Fronsdale, one of my teachers, talks about how he spent 3 days on a retreat designing helicopters in his mind. And he didn't know anything about actual helicopter design. And he didn't really even know where that came from, but he just got caught up doing it for 3 days before he realized, wait, what am I doing? So, and I think just, talking about it, studying it, it just helps us start to notice it more and have more, awareness of how it's operating in our own mind. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. I think that's probably it, right? All right. And thanks to those of you that were on camera or on screen, because it was nice to have a few faces to relate to. All right. But also happy for everybody who was able to join us tonight. Take care, everybody.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.